Welcome to the Revolutionary Health Podcast. I am your host, Stephanie Center. I am a licensed clinician in search of how to live a meaningful and healthy life. I challenge both traditional and functional medicine ideologies in search of truth and wisdom. I allow room for curiosity and always keep an open mind. I enjoy deep conversations with my guests, giving them a safe space to share their research and personal observation, as I feel both equally contribute to the body of knowledge and human experience. Note that the opinions of my guests do not always reflect my own, whether I share that openly or not. And of course, the podcast is for educational purposes only. We do not offer medical advice. So grab a cup of coffee and join me for some intimate and unique discussions about finding wellness in the 21st century. Hello and Happy New Year. Welcome to Revolutionary Health. I am your host, Stephanie Center. You know, I always giggle to myself at the title of this show because there is nothing revolutionary about what I do. It's so backwards that we live in a world where getting sunlight and eating nutrient-dense food and replenishing lost minerals is considered revolutionary. Or perhaps it is forward-thinking to realize taking ownership of your health and not relying on a medication to make you feel well is the alternative path. Anyway, I have hope for the future. Today's episode, I know, has been long awaited. This is my Q&A with Morley Robbins and Jim Stevenson Jr. on vitamin, or more accurately, hormone D. If you are just new here coming in, I have a few previous episodes with Morley and Jim that I recommend you listening to first. I believe they are episodes 49 and 51, but please don't quote me. Go look for yourself. I really recommend listening to those before the Q&A. So I took all of your questions and I categorized them by topic. I was only able to include questions that were asked by multiple people because there were just too many questions to fit into one show. So thank you all for submitting your wonderful questions. And I really hope that yours is answered today in some way, shape, or form. There were a lot of questions about the relationship between vitamin D and autoimmunity, COVID and vitamin D. And then we had some clarification questions in response to a previous episode on the relationship between vitamin D and vitamin A. So I really encouraged both Morley and Jim to break things down into simple terms so that you don't need a medical background to understand what they are saying. If you need anything from me, if you listen to this episode and you want more information, you can find me on Instagram at Holistic Stephanie Marie. I try to keep that page updated with different fun facts and figures about vitamin D. I share some other things too about glyphosate and hormone health. And I do have a research highlight on my Instagram page if you're wanting articles. I just don't have the time and capacity to be adding all of these articles to the show notes anymore. So really, Instagram is the best place to go for those articles if you're wanting them. Or you can jot and take notes as Morley and Jim are talking and look the articles up for yourself. Most of them are free. Some of them you do have to pay for. You can also visit my website, theholistichouse.org. I keep that updated as well. And you can find links to both my website and my Instagram in the show notes. I will continue to release new episodes this year. They will just be at a slower pace. If you don't know me or my situation, I just had a baby. So I am adjusting to motherhood. I also still work full-time and I run my own company. So I'm trying to find a rhythm and balance while I continue to share important information with you. So thanks for your patience while I do that. As far as functional lab testing goes, Rach, who is the holistic nutritionist that I partner with, we are opening up enrollment for Own Your Hormones February 6th through the 17th. That is a group program that includes Dutch testing. So to learn more about that and hop on our wait list, you can click the Own Your Hormones link in the show notes. We offer this program twice a year. So if you're listening to this episode and enrollment has ended, hop on our wait list for the next release. As always, if you enjoy this episode, please consider sharing it with a friend. I do not monetize my podcast, so that means that I don't make money off of it. I want people to know that they can trust the information that I share without muddying the waters with money. So that means I also don't have a budget to advertise for this podcast. It's all word of mouth. So for me to continue to have a good enough presence and following to get the stellar guests that I have, I need your help in sharing the message. So please consider sharing this with a friend, a family member, talk about it on social media. I really appreciate you sharing this message. I think it's important, and that's why I have the podcast. So thanks for your support. All right, friends, are you ready for this Q&A? Let's dive in. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome back to Revolutionary Health. I am your host, Stephanie Center, and I have two of my favorite people back here today, Mr. Morley Robbins and Jim Stevenson Jr. We're doing part three of our series on vitamin D. I want to thank you all for your thoughtful questions. I've had so many people reach out about these episodes we've been doing. And my hope today is to give you clarity to some of the questions. I've got a lot of questions that you've all submitted, and I kind of picked up on some recurring themes. And so my hope today is to clarify some aspects of vitamin D and vitamin A too, I think is on here as well, so that we can kind of really understand why this is so important. So you can go out and vote with your dollars and you know, change the landscape of what we see in our stores. So thank you both so much for being here.
Sure, you're welcome.
Does anybody have any comments before I dive into questions?
I don't.
Well, I think we should celebrate the fact that everyone's vitamin D is at its lowest levels because it's summertime. And Jim can explain why.
Ooh, I love that. That's a great way to start.
Okay, I'm going to turn up my speakers here. Okay. So what's the question again in the form of a question?
Well, why is my vitamin D so low? Or why is my vitamin D so high now that it's summertime? Because it's always so low in the winter. I don't understand that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's simple. It's because the proxy that they're going to use to determine your vitamin D status is going to be the 25D, which is going to be higher now because your UVB is present now and you're making D3 and it's daily being converted to 25D. And so it's going to be higher now naturally because there's a seasonal variation in that molecule. But keep in mind, the active form that is the immune response molecule that's made from that doesn't have a seasonal variation. Even when you were lower with your wax and wane of it in the winter, that didn't vary at all. That's tied to your immune response, and that's what's going to drive it. And it's able to be created from storage of that 25D.
Great, great response. And I was reading an article yesterday that you all, both of you would really have enjoyed. Actually, I sent it to you, but I'm not sure you've had a chance to read it. Mm-hmm. But there was a specific reference to the fact that they were supplementing D to these little rodents to see the D go up. And that there was a specific sentence that said, and this supplementation had no effect on the active level. And it went right to the point that Jim makes about the fact that they have this, the storage has a fluctuation.
Right.
It fluxes with the light. And the reason why is because storage D is sunglasses. It's a light filter. Right. And it's a very different function than what people think. And the active D is just steady as a rock in the body. And I'm so grateful, Jim, for you pointing that out, because no one had ever explained it so clearly that there is this striking difference between the two forms. And I think maybe one of the most important things you've shared with people is it's a storage molecule. It's not supposed to be in the blood.
Right. Blood is not storage. It's like I always say, it's like the fuel line in your car.
Yep.
And like your car, the fuel line varies whether the car is running or not. Is your car running at that time? Does your body have a need for that vitamin D? If not, that's like the car not running, and it's not a good place to check. I have some papers. I haven't had a chance to look at them, but they are alleging, and I don't know which molecule they're using, that the ocular fluid of the eye is a better barometer of vitamin D status in the body than the blood.
Wow. That's fascinating.
That's fascinating, because we know that the eye makes some vitamin D, and it's involved in controlling a lot of processes surrounding vitamin D, like melanogenesis and stuff like that. So that's pretty fascinating. And maybe in the future, we'll have a chance to talk about those papers.
That's cool.
Wow. So for the person listening who's thinking to themselves still, okay, but I live in northern Michigan, and in the wintertime, it's cold. What you're saying is, although your storage D is going to fluctuate throughout the year, you do not need to be afraid of winter, because your body is wise and prepares for winter.
Right.
And your active D remains steady.
Right. And they'll sell you the idea that that deficiency in winter drives the diseases that we see and conditions and, mm-hmm. and all the things that happen in winter. But the fact of the matter is, that's when we get sick. And that's with the exception of, say, polio, which is a June, July kind of thing. And it has to do with absolute humidity and school quarters and things like that, proximity to other people. And then they relocate and carry things with them and expose to new things. And it's not because your vitamin D is lower in winter. That's another false correlation equals causation driven home using that falsehood right there.
Yes. And I think the last time we met, you both did a really nice job of saying that you're not sick because you have low vitamin D. You have low vitamin D because you are sick.
Exactly.
That hit home for me. So thank you for explaining that.
Right.
And let's just make sure we really clarify that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's storage and active. Storage is fluctuating, active is steady. Mm-hmm. And storage has an enzyme to make it, and active has an enzyme to make it.
Correct.
And the storage enzyme is found in the liver, and the active is principally found in the kidney, but it's actually found throughout the tissue.
Right.
But the important point is that when vitamin D is low, it's not like your fuel gauge. It's like miles per gallon.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference between an empty fuel gauge and low miles per gallon. So there's variables involved in miles per gallon. And so to make the storage D, you've got to have magnesium. And when people are under stress, whether the stress is you've got a deadline, you've had an argument with your spouse, you've got to relocate, whatever, or you're just dealing with life in general. And the greatest stress in our body, bar none, is called oxidative stress. We breathe oxygen in, and we got to do something with it. And if we don't do it right, it's going to create what are called oxidants. But when that happens, when there is oxidative stress, it affects the level of magnesium. And there's magnesium loss to that stress. It doesn't matter what the stress is. The body is agnostic about the source of stress. There is magnesium loss, and we call it the magnesium burn rate within the RCP community. Mm-hmm. And if magnesium is low, well, then the enzyme to make storage D is going to be low. And as Jim says, it's a reflection of the stress you're under, of not being at an optimal level. And that's the issue that no one's talking about, is the missing question. This whole discussion is, why is my storage D low? It's low because you're under stress and your magnesium is being tanked, and we need to find out why. And usually the biggest source of the magnesium loss is too much iron in the body, and it burns up magnesium. So again, people just need to understand that there's more than one variable involved here.
Right.
And when it's low, you need to ask the question, why is it low?
Right. You made me think of a paper that's mostly about Gardasil, because Gardasil messes with some of those enzymes, those CYP450 enzymes, especially ones involved in steroid system, including vitamin D. And in that same article, it talks about vaccines a little bit and the insult. So you can have a physical insult or the stress, like you're talking about, being an emotional insult. And this article gets at that the body can't tell the difference between those two. The fight or flight response is the same for right. both, and you dump magnesium.
Exactly. It's the most basic part of our physiology that I don't think people understand that we, and again, we've just come off of 2 years of a lot of stress around the world. People don't realize the amount of magnesium was lost on this planet in the last 2 years.
Oh yeah. And they, it's not added to anything, but calcium is, and you need magnesium at 2 to 1 for calcium just to begin with, not even talking about being there to activate vitamin D and all of the other reactions that it's involved in.
Yeah, that's the research of Ki Dai. He's a professor at, oh my goodness, my mind just, Vanderbilt University. Sorry for the brain stop, but 2012. And what he discovered is that most formulations of calcium to magnesium is 2 parts calcium to 1 part magnesium. And what he found is you can't absorb magnesium when there's too much calcium. And then he flipped it and discovered that when there's twice as much magnesium as there is calcium, you optimize calcium absorption and use in the body. It's a really important study that he did about 10 years ago.
Right. Just the fact that it's not fortified for me is just kind of a warning sign, because right. everything that is fortified is suspect for one reason or another. And then the stuff we need really isn't there.
Right.
Wow. Oh, we're like 5 minutes in and you've already blown my mind. I love the way you brought that full circle. I think you've already answered the first question, which is why isn't supplementing with vitamin D helping my immune system? And I think that we've kind of got, you know, we started our conversation with that essentially when you talked about summer versus winter. Is there anything you want to add?
I think the other side of it, though, I think the other side of it is, and this is a point again, I give Jim just tremendous credit for putting all the pieces of the puzzle together. When everyone hears that vitamin D is faster than a speeding bullet and, able to leap tall buildings, what have you, what we're talking about is a 3-part mechanism. We're talking about active D, the active form of this metabolite, being complexed with something called the vitamin D receptor. And then the third leg of the stool, which is really critical, is something called RXR, and that's the retinoid X receptor that can only be made if you have vitamin A in your diet. And those three need to come together in order to provide, I guess, this proper genetic transcription. Is that what it would be, Jim?
Yeah, it would be.
Okay. And so, again, that's when the immune system changes, is when the three come together. It isn't right. just a single, you need more vitamin D to strengthen your immune system.
Right.
That's a very incorrect or very incomplete understanding of the mechanism.
Right. And it would come together because it already had something the body had decided it wanted to make.
Right.
And that's why it came together to begin with. It might be ready to make a macrophage or something, but that's the immune response. It's going to make something. But the problem is that that molecule that we're talking about is the active one, like you said, and they're not checking it. And earlier you talked about how the liver or the kidneys activate it to the active form, the one that does this that we're talking about right here, heterodimerizing. And that one right there, as you said, can be created in the tissues. So now let's talk about why isn't supplementing vitamin D3 helping me? Well, it's possible that that person's need for vitamin D was being taken care of by D3 before it ever even went to the liver and became 2,5-D at the cell and tissue level. It was going there and being activated to 2,5-D and to 125-D, and it didn't have to ever be in the blood as 2,5-D. And so it, and they maybe weren't low. Nobody gets their D3 tested. So they might have been completely meeting their needs. But as we know, most of the people that are sick aren't truly low in vitamin D. When you look at the active form, they actually have too much, unfortunately.
And the other part of this question, Stephanie, is that at the end of the day, in order to strengthen our immune system, we need to be able to make energy. The immune system runs on energy. And so what I've done is gone into the literature to say, how do different metabolites of mitochondria, and especially complex four of the mitochondria, which is where the action is, where oxygen becomes water to release the energy molecules. And vitamin D has no activity around the mitochondria, especially complex four. But that's not the truth of vitamin A. Vitamin A has tremendous sway in the mitochondria, especially in something called the signalosome. I won't get into all of that right now because I think the folks in Peoria are going to freak out. But the important thing is vitamin A is involved in energy production. Vitamin D is not. And that, to me, is what distinguishes the two metabolites. And when someone says, why isn't it affecting my immune system? Because it's not helping to make any energy. And vitamin A runs, I have a bias. I think everyone knows that. But I think vitamin A runs circles around vitamin D because of its complexity, the very various components of it, the different retinoids that it produces, and the fact that it can make energy or help contribute to making energy. So that to me is that separates the wheat from the chaff between A and D. So,
and, you know, there was a time when I was a little resistant to that, just because I know vitamin D makes your immune response molecules, including the antimicrobial peptides work, which are super, super amazing. But the more I read, the more I found that not just vitamin D, the VDR, the vitamin D receptor, not only does it as a receptor couple with the RXR, I almost all of them that I've really looked into do, not just it. For example, 2 days ago, I was looking at a molecule. It has cholesterol in its name. I think it begins with a 22. It doesn't matter. But it's made with in the side cleavage enzyme, where I found all these other enzymes. But it doesn't matter. It looks like it's a sun-produced molecule. And it's a major molecule that goes to the liver receptor. And receptor is coupled with the RXR. They heterodimerize to do their thing. That's pretty fascinating. And when I find out exactly if it's made in the sun or just made from sun-derived molecules, I'll update you. But that really blew my mind. And again, the RXR is there with the same molecule that would be on the thyroid receptor and on with the VDR. And so you just keep looking and you're going to find that it's super important. It's super important. And it's fortified for us, I should say. So there's more to it. That didn't fix everything, obviously, you know, and so there's more to the story.
And just so people have a sense of, they may have heard RXR before, I'm sure in other earlier conversations, but to amplify it, you can't make thyroid hormone without RXR. There's so many different hormones that are dependent upon that. It's called retinoid X receptor. It's a derivative of vitamin A. And it's not hidden in the research. You just scratch at it and you're going to find it, but it's not well publicized or promoted on the internet. And so it doesn't get the recognition that it deserves.
Right. No, you're right. And getting back to the active molecule and how you said it's we talked about how it doesn't drop in the winter, and it's tightly regulated. It's made as needed until you're in trouble. Then when you're in trouble, it's no longer tightly regulated. And that's when, as a molecule, it'll steal other receptors, and it steals that one receptor that you were just talking about that's on the other side of the RXR in the thyroid. It'll steal that one. We talked about that last time with the graphics, or the time before. I think it was the time before when I did the graphics and we showed the affinity to those receptors. And so you don't have one side or the other. You have a failing of that system.
Yeah.
Right. And I think what people need to understand is that Jim has referred to acute microbial peptides. Mm-hmm. Why are they coming around? Because iron is rising in the tissue. And again, it's very basic dynamics between the metals, but iron feeds all these pathogens. They thrive on iron. They replicate on iron. And so when the active form of vitamin D starts to rise, what it's doing is it's turning the active metabolite, active vitamin D, into an acute microbial peptide to try to keep the pathogens at bay. And Jim, I'm sure you can comment on it more eloquently, but when I read that in Meg Mangan's article from 2014, that was a game changer to right. understand that this active form has this metabolic role to really improve our homeostasis by getting rid of the pathogens.
Right. And if you remember when we looked at those systems last time, those other systems made those microbial peptides too. Right. In fact, vitamin D receptor made the least amount. They made the same ones, a lot of them. And so here, I'll add a little bit to that. So those, there's no immunity to those. That's why they are able to block its creation, because if it exists, so the ones around that fit in, say, the vitamin D receptor, so that it can't do its job and make that, those are the pathogens that we still have around today. And so it blocks them. But at the core, it's a historic thing. It's, for example, the vitamin D receptors, I won't go too deep, but they communicate with other receptors like the toll-like receptors, the TLR right. receptors.
Sure.
And right. those TLR receptors recognize molecules that are from pathogens that have been around forever, that won't advance even as they mutate and move on. So these molecules are stable in their genome, let's say. Right. So they're always going to recognize them, and they're going to then, through quorum sensing, small talk, they have ways of communicating, all these sensors, they'll then let the vitamin D receptors and the gene, more likely than the receptor, know what's going on and prepare for this assault, because those toll-like receptors are in the surfaces of things like macrophages and T cells. Okay.
Sure. Yep.
Okay. So if I can bring us back to clarity, just for our listeners. So right. when we're talking about why isn't supplementing with vitamin D helping your immune system, there's two major things that I'm gleaning from this. Is one, that when you are supplementing with vitamin D, that's not the same as consuming the active form. And that's right. the form that we associate with immune system support. And it's not, so you're consuming that storage form, and there's not necessarily a guarantee that the storage form will transition to active, correct?
Right. It's not a ratio or a throughput thing. It doesn't work like that unless you're already in trouble, and then it's presence that can happen because you have a cytokine storm, so to speak. And it's not being dealt with, you know, right. so these pathogens are rising unabated. And so is that level of vitamin D, because it can't do its job and it's wrecking and taking out the other systems. So you're having a complete downfall of homeostasis in your body. I mean, you know, just the thyroid being gained right there, it's a serious hit.
That's right.
And the second thing that I'm gleaning, and this is something, Morley, that you brought up, is that when you are taking vitamin D, you're depleting magnesium, and it takes energy to fight off anything. Like, you need right. energy to right. to maintain health. Right. And so if you're taking vitamin D, you're depleting magnesium, and you're depleting your body's ability to make energy to fight off whatever you might come in contact with.
Right.
Yeah. The immune system needs energy, and it needs intelligence. And we got to keep that front and center. It's really very okay. important.
Thank you.
A lot of those people are taking the vitamin D because they want to help their body, but they aren't even able to trust their body with the nutrition
right.
to begin with. And they're going to trust their body with this pill of vitamin D. And it's somehow, I mean, I think phototherapy or you know, going out in the sun would be a much better, reasonable, would be a much better option than, or a food source, of course, because you can get a, you can get a decent food source. You can get a decent amount through food.
Yeah. Sure. I feel like we kind of answered this one too, but the next question was, what is the difference between stored and active D? And I feel like you all have answered that by talking about how you need enzymes from your liver for storage D, enzymes from your kidney. And I didn't know if also other tissues for active D. Is there anything else you wanted to add to that?
Just realize that we're using the term storage wrong when we're when we're pointing to our 2,5-D test. That is the storage molecule that mm-hmm. it tested, but that's not your storage amount.
Right.
That's yeah. a very, you know, it's stored even in bone. We've known that probably for 100 years now that it gets stored even in bone.
That's great.
Yeah, that's a really important point. I've also heard it referred to as circulating D. Is that a better term for it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's the circulating amount of storage. Yeah, I think people are finally getting used to the fact that they realize that it's stored. Maybe they don't realize it's still stored. It had to have go to the liver and become 2,5-D, and mm-hmm. the vast majority of it stays there. See, so it had to leave there. So the body had to make the choice to say, this is the amount we're letting out. Think about the non-fat soluble molecule B12. It's not like the other water solubles. I'm not saying the others are like this, but there's 2 years of B12 in your liver, you know, and you have to be careful if you're hunting and you kill, say, a polar bear eating the liver, there can be too much vitamin A, a fat soluble. So there's just a certain amount the body decided to let out into the blood of that form of storage molecule, but it's holding on to it that, you know, like we know organ meats are a very healthy source of stored nutrients. And that's why people have historically eaten them.
Yeah.
How much B12 is there? What did you say? 2 years?
They say 2 years worth. So when you're out of B12 and they're happy to do a medical intervention of a shot of the synthetic form, mm-hmm. that's one vitamin that they will play with in mainstream, mm-hmm. you yeah. know, but they won't find out what's really going on with your B12, which is that's usually, right. you know, a gut issue, intrinsic factor, something else like that.
Yeah.
That's actually my favorite topic, is intrinsic factor. Like, what do you mean intrinsic factor? And it turns out that the intrinsic factor is transported by a protein called cubulin, C-U-B-U-L-I-N.
Oh, wow.
Anytime I see the initial C-U, you know what I think about.
Right.
I think either the intrinsic factor or cubulin, copper's in there somewhere. But no one ever talks about it. But that's just my quirky theory about the B12 molecule.
Well, I didn't realize that about it. You know, it's at play with the docking of the vitamin D binding protein.
Okay.
So yeah, that's
interesting.
Megulin and cubulin.
Cubulin, exactly. Yeah.
So yeah. I probably said the first one wrong, but if you were to try to Google them,
we won't count.
Probably not the first one for you and get you there.
Yeah. We still love you, man. Okay. Come on.
That's good.
I'm loving this conversation. Morley, this one might be for you. So I've had multiple people say, okay, after the last discussion, I understand that vitamin D depletes vitamin A, but I don't understand why that's important. And I've had a couple people mention, so I put this in the question too. I never hear about vitamin A except with acne, and I don't have acne. But I think what they don't know they're talking about is the high dose, like Accutane, which is synthetic vitamin A. It's not even the same.
Right. Yeah. Right. And it was based on a specific molecule there, CIS, and then they have a number, CIS and a number. And it was a specific one.
13 CIS. The reason why A is so important is it's what makes copper bioavailable. Now, we live in a world where people don't know what minerals are in general. Well, they may have heard of calcium and sort of heard of magnesium. They certainly have heard of iron. They've never heard of copper. They don't know what it does. And so just to really quickly summarize it, there's mm-hmm. only four things that copper does in the body. It creates energy. It clears exhaust. It catalyzes enzymes, particularly the oxidase enzymes, which are really important. Mm-hmm. And the fourth thing it does is it combats enemies. All the pathogens cave in the presence of copper. So it turns out that this lowly little element is pivotal in our health and well-being. And you can't make copper usable and bioavailable unless you can load it into its enzymes. And there are what are called copper pumps to load the copper into those enzymes. They're really, really important. One's called ATP7A, the other's called ATP7B. And the thing is, if we solely focus on vitamin D, the receptor to absorb the fat-soluble vitamins, it's binary. And it's going to take either A or D. And if it's constantly getting signals for D, there's no A that's going to get into the system. And what we're describing as it relates to copper is just one function of retinol. It's instrumental in vision. It's instrumental in our liver function. The liver function is essentially the intersection of iron and copper metabolism. It's basically, it's a Rife machine. For those who know what that is, it's an incredibly powerful source of frequency that helps to keep pathogens at bay. But it also goes on, as I mentioned earlier, that vitamin A is involved in energy production. There's a very critical part of the mitochondria where electrons need to get from complex 3 to complex 4. And if that doesn't happen, mitochondria doesn't work right. Well, it turns out that the electrons ride the retinol molecule to get from complex 3 to complex 4. It's a really big deal, and no one ever talks about it. And why is it such a big deal? Well, if retinol is not present, there's something called the Warburg effect that begins to take place inside the mitochondria. And the Warburg effect is the cell has oxygen, but it doesn't activate the oxygen because it doesn't have any copper. It doesn't activate the oxygen. It ferments the oxygen, and that's called cancer. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that in 1925, a physician named Montrose T. Burroughs got his medical degree at Johns Hopkins. I think he actually got his degree in 21, but in 1925 and four times in 1926, he published articles. He was working at the Rockefeller Institute. That might mean something to folks out there. But he published five articles that proved that retinol deficiency caused cancer. And so there's whole pockets of information that we've not been told about that Jim and I and Stephanie labor overtime to try to make sure people are aware of what's going on. But when you start pumping a lot of D in the body and it's not found, what you really want to be doing is taking cod liver oil. I'm sure at some point we'll talk about that. But cod liver oil has a mixture of A and D, but it has 10 times more A than D. That's significant. There's a reason for that. And so the hyper focus on D is done at the cost to vitamin A. And then we lose all these critical functions of how do we make sure that the mitochondria are working right? How do we make sure we don't get cancer? How do we make sure that the copper is able to do all of those critical jobs that it does? And so we live in a very monocentric world. You know, people think about one thing. One nutrient. I focus on one nutrient. I can't process more than one. It's like, that's not how the body works. The body is all about frick and frack, yin and yang. You know, it's critical to have this understanding of the dual nature of these pathways. And so excess D at the expense of A is a very serious metabolic affront to the body. So I hope that helps.
Mic drop.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I hope the folks out in Peoria or wherever they are, I hope they enjoy the benefit of that information.
Why? Okay, I have a follow-up question to that then. Because and I think last time you cited research from the 1920s. So if we've known about this for 100 years, why aren't we doing anything? Like, if this isn't cutting edge new information, this is information that's been accessible for a century. Why do we hear about chemotherapy and not,
right,
you know?
No, it's a great question. We live on a very paradoxical planet. And I don't think there's a really good answer. Because there are probably 100 different questions we could ask like that. And I think what we're striving to do here is give people the unvarnished truth, let them come to their own judgment about what makes sense, and start making decisions based on that new information. But there's a lot of, there's a difference between the narrative and Mother Nature. And I think what we're really trying to do is pull back the curtain on Mother Nature so that people understand, how does the body really work? Not how do they want us to think it works? That's the difference.
That nailed it. I'm going to use that as a segue to say what I wanted to say too.
That's perfect.
Because you were asking why, if all this stuff is common knowledge, right? Like we talked before about antibodies and fat.
Sure.
And there's a TED talk about, how do you deal with diabetes? You ignore the guidelines. That's basically what the title of that TED Talk is. You should watch it. She's having success throwing all the guidelines out because the fat thing was just wrong, right? But the reason why is because a minute ago I was talking about the toll-like receptors. And so I wanted to know what molecules go to the toll-like receptors, the ligands, however you pronounce it. And lo and behold, they're those historic molecules tied to pathogens. That's how they recognize them arriving in the body. Right. And so what ended up happening is big pharma or somebody who wants to have their own little niche of making drugs is then going to take that and they're going to figure out what kind of molecule they can, like maybe replace the tuberculosis ligand with, and maybe have palliative effect in treating TB. So we're not finding out about how the immune system works at all because they're ahead of us finding out their big pharma drugs that then will go and steal receptors. Even if you go and find out what's truly wrong with you and you're exposed to those drugs, you won't even be able to write the system then because they will have stolen your system, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because they need any molecule they make to be first on race day, no matter who it knocks out of the race, no matter what natural molecule. So even as you figure out the right natural molecules down the road, if you're a victim of big pharma that did some palliative effect to you, it's all they are. That's all they can ever be. They don't fix what's wrong at the root. They're not DNA patches or anything like that. So that's what's gone on. Somebody's gone along. Like once I found those orphan retinoid receptors that took all of those other vitamin D molecules in that pathway I was talking about a minute ago, I found that they already had market portfolios. So if Morley and I wanted to sit down and work in molecule creation and stuff, we could see who's the big players, how many molecules have they made, what are they treating. Those portfolios cost about $4,500. And so that world is not at all the world that the sick people are in when they're going on the merry-go-round to the Mayo Clinic and here and there and to the specialty cancer treatments. You know, it's all about making a drug. It's not about fixing the root cause.
That's right.
There you go, Morley, root cause.
That's right. Thank you.
Morley knows that I really struggle with this because I am a resident of Bedford Falls, and it's really hard for me when I have to come to terms with the fact that I live in Pottersville.
Yeah, that's right.
That's really, so these questions. Yeah.
It was a very important conversation we had. Yeah.
That was our first conversation, and that really changed the trajectory of the reading that I was doing at the time and the research, because I was in a position where I was sick, and I worked in traditional medicine. I worked as an occupational therapist, so I wasn't in the pharmaceutical industry, but I was like, okay, I'm not a snowflake. These people aren't snowflakes. If it's not working for me, it's not working for them. It's not working for anybody. And that, the way you said that to me just really hit home of like, well, George, you're not in Bedford Falls. You're not, Dorothy, you're not in Kansas. You know, it's.
And I think if anyone after the last 2 years still thinks they're in Bedford Falls, that's where part of the problem is.
Right.
I think we need to wake up to the reality of where we really live.
Yeah.
Right. You have to take some of that cynicism, lay it back into the times and when the world had great bottlenecks, when there was famine and loss of great wealth, and there were only a few people that came through it with wealth and influence, and their wealth and influence is huge. When the Rockefellers bailed out the higher institutions, they asked for seats on the board. And so they directed everything to a pill for every ill. And so this happened back in a long time ago, you know, in the 30s and whatnot. So, and a lot of them got bad reputations, and they had people help them with their reputations. Like Pillsbury had a terrible reputation. He's a powerhouse from that kind of time, not in big pharma, but a powerhouse nonetheless, right? Mm-hmm. To this day, and had a terrible reputation. And a guy, Gates, said, let's do efficiency and philanthropy. And that's where the sponsorship model came, where you either walk miles and somebody sponsors you, or the company does a dime for every dime you do. And it's just, you know, they've done these things in the past, and the Rockefellers and them, they have a lot to do with the medical industry today.
Yeah, that's right.
Gives me a lot to digest.
Yeah.
Our next question. Oh, I thought this was an interesting one. So this is kind of getting at research and different ways to interpret research and why you really need to know what you're reading. So the question is, why are there so many studies that show people with a higher vitamin D level do better with COVID?
Okay. All right. So yeah, this is a great one. So here's why. So let's take everyone that has COVID that they have the data on. And all of those people that have COVID, unfortunately, they're only going to have their 2,5-D data. First of all, we have to all agree on that. And people have to know that. If you don't know that first, that's hurdle number one. That's the only molecule they got measured in all those people. So when they say, why did the people with lower vitamin D why did the people with higher vitamin D do better with COVID? That's 2,5-D. Okay, so now thinking about that, and let's even include intervention. So here's why. Because those people, we talked about this earlier, those people aren't sick. They aren't making a bunch of 125-D, the active form. Maybe they aren't suffering from Epstein-Barr virus flares, which the Epstein-Barr is stealing their vitamin D receptors, but still causing them to have a bunch of vitamin D, and they lost their thyroid. Well, that person's not going to do very good. And there's a prime example of someone with low 2,5-D that's not going to fare well, possibly with COVID. And it wasn't tied to their 2,5-D. That was the marker for the other illness. And cancer, same way. Cancer is really interesting because the tumors themselves, they have vitamin D receptors, and they'll gobble up tons of vitamin D on you. So it's not going to really be in working on COVID for you per se. But it's the intervention studies that drive this myth home. So let's talk about the intervention study. This is where the focus changes from the baseline number of 2,5-D, because it's all you have again. So never forget that. You don't have their 1,2,5-D. So their 2,5-D number improved. And the people whose number improved do better. Why? because they had access to the vitamin D receptors for vitamin D. They, again, weren't the people who were already sequestering 2,5-D. If you're able to increase your level of vitamin D without taking insane levels, there's probably not that much wrong with you, at least not in that world. Not in that need, that immune response that's going to make antimicrobial peptides and T cells and macrophages and stuff like that. That doesn't mean that you might have a bunch of gut issues or some other stuff, but that the ability to increase your 2,5-D is a big deal. And people that take vitamin D and it drops, those are the ones that are in the most trouble. And that happens because their body didn't want it. And now you put more in and it really slammed on the brakes.
That's right.
So does that make sense? It's better to think of the intervention studies because they drive it home, and those people increase. They didn't have a comorbid condition. If you looked at most of those people, they had something wrong with them that weren't able to increase their 2,5-D. And a study, you could sell a study that'd be more scientific if you said these people came in and they didn't, their 1,2,5-D was low, which we don't see. But let's imagine you did. And then they gave them some D3. Sometimes they give them 2,5-D in those interventions. And their 1,2,5-D went up. Then they could have had an immune response following that they maybe were lacking. Then at least you'd say, hey, that's at least plausible. This other one's a fairy tale because you could do the same thing with magnesium. You could do the same thing with vitamin A. You could do B12. You could take any of those COVID people, because when you have nutrition issues, you have nutrition issues. And so those people are probably really low in red blood cell magnesium. Good luck getting a paper. Why don't we write that paper, Morley? Let's see what kind of success we have in publishing it. We could approach medical hypothesis with it if you wanted to. But you watch, it would not get published.
A general chooses their battles. We don't need to do that.
Yeah, it'd be a waste of time right now.
It's not going to go anywhere.
Scientific paper. So the atmosphere is right, and it's what it's hiding. If you ask me, this deficiency has to exist because of how it began. It began with rickets, and rickets is fascinating. Had not been for rickets, we might not have really figured out sun-produced molecules. It really blew their mind that nutrition basically could come from the sun, and they didn't understand how part of putting a little bit of sun on an arm over here kills the whole body. And there was a lot of other weird stuff, but I don't want to give too much away because I'm writing a paper about it right now. But so had it not been for that, and then they don't want to talk about the lack of compulsory education and the lack of child labor laws that caused all those kids to have rickets, and they've been. There's a lot of people benefiting to this day. We have fortification, a lot of pills on the shelves, there's a lot of tests moving. So it's pretty lucrative, but I think they don't really want people to realize that had it not been for those circumstances, and they can't drive home the fear of rickets now, because if when you look at a graph of the general population, everyone should have rickets according to the numbers, and they don't. So, it's just interesting.
Okay. So to make sure that I understand this and that Nancy in Missouri understands this, you're saying that, if somebody is showing a higher 2,5-D level and they're faring better with COVID, it's because they weren't sick to begin with.
Right. Exactly. Especially if it was a natural level. Some people have a really high natural level. There's a lot of other stuff clicking in their body to allow that. Not everyone that you would label healthy that would go in the sun would end up with approaching 60, which we kind of considered that threshold. Your mortality increases above 54. So that threshold really makes sense. The body, through the feedbacks, limits the blood level of getting higher than that. So it stands to reason.
Yeah, love that. Our next question, I've had several people ask this, so I just wanted to add this in. What does secosteroid mean? Because we're talking about vitamin D as a secosteroid hormone. What does that mean?
Okay, so if you were to look at a drawing of a molecule and that would be what we consider a two-dimensional molecule, right? And so it would have like its components, carbon, hydrogen, whatever. there's this one spot on it where three segments of one of the hexagons called a B ring is not closed. And that's all it is. That's the absolute difference between it and a steroid. The effect is the same. It's a steroid class molecule, and it's the most powerful steroid class molecule that our bodies make, at least that I've read about. I know higher class molecules. I don't know. There could be some literature out there that designates them steroids at a higher level. I hadn't thought about that till just now, but as we know it. And you mentioned earlier about 125D, and I want to say the goal is not to chase higher 125D. The goal is to let the body not get dysregulated and manage that number. And the reason why it'd be like talking about steroids and steroids, like playing with adrenaline or something like that, you know, in a way. That's what's in tomatoes directly. The active form of vitamin D is in tomatoes. And a lot of people feel they have a food allergy to that. And so there's some stuff at Weston Nape.
Oh.
The reason why you would. I don't think tomatoes are bad for you. I'm not saying that at all. But there might be some people that are hypersensitive to getting more active vitamin D in their body. Or it might be some other nightshade related thing. But Weston Nape Price talks about it if you want to read about it.
Real quick, let me just jump in, Stephanie, and I'm not going to comment on the SECO. I think Jim's done that beautifully. But he brought up something that made me think about there needs to be a ratio of active to storage. They're really supposed to be in approximation of each other. Mm-hmm. And again, contrary to a lot of popular recommendations that want people to have storage D up in the 60s, 80s, get up to 100. A very important study was done at Hopkins. I think it was 2013, but it was Muhammad Amer. I think it was 2013, where, and Jim referred to this study in some of our earlier conversations, but there was no clinical benefit to storage D being above 21 nanograms per deciliter. And I think Jim also pointed out that back in the 80s, or up until the 80s, that a healthy storage D was in the teens. It wasn't even in the 20s. So what's really helpful for people who really want to get into the weeds of this, there's an endocrinologist in Brussels, and his name is Kenny, middle initial L, last name, De Meulier, D-E-M-E-I-R-L-E-I-R, and he's an MD, PhD, and you can find there's videos with him talking about the relationship between storage and active. And he's very quick to tell people that the American medical system is out of line with what's needed, and that the active number. And again, storage is measuring nanograms, active is measuring picograms. So it's a different unit of measurement. But the number for active should be about 1.5 to 2 times the level of the storage. So when you say, okay, well, let's say Muhammad Amer is right about 21. So maybe the active should be about 40 to 45. What's important for people to know that I've had clients where the active was up in the 70s, which is just a very high number. And so it really begins to skew the communication in the body. And the body really knows how much it needs. And this artificial priming of the storage pump really starts to affect the active and puts a lot of pressure on it. When the active is trying to stay steady, it keeps getting bumped up by the storage level. But the 1.5 to 2 times the number is very important for people to be aware of. But more important than that is getting your active and your storage measured so that you have a more complete understanding of what your vitamin D metabolism is doing.
Mm.
Just wanted to point that out.
Right.
This question is near and dear to my heart right now. Why is vitamin D recommended for babies? I think last time we talked about how breast milk does not contain vitamin D, but formula does. And a lot of pediatricians and obstetricians are recommending that women give their babies vitamin D.
I would love to know why. Okay. It makes no sense to me clinically, but Jim, what's your thought about that?
They blame it on breast milk. They say, so keep in mind that they set a goal for 25D and they were able to increase that goal for 25D. So that's going to be the proxy when they look at your breast milk. And natural breast milk is going to, even cow's natural milk and all this, isn't going to have the amount that they set the goal at. So then they're going to take the babies and the conditions, and they're going to find a way using the 25D to craft studies that prop up the breast milk needs to be higher. Look at these mothers that had higher breast milk and their baby's outcomes, higher 25D in their breast milk, and look at their baby's outcomes. But again, that's just like, look at the people who did better with COVID and their 25D. Yeah. You have that whole thing again. And at play is the fact that pregnant women's active form of vitamin D spikes 40%. It's already super, super, super high. So the question would be, you know, riddle me this, my little wizard. What is more 25D for if these women already have an excess of the product that's going to become? What's it for?
That's a great
insight. What's it for, you know?
I'm writing that down. That's great.
I have a theory, but I'm not sure this is the program to share it, because I think it may be too much too fast. But maybe in round four, if we ever have one, that we can get into that.
Well, and my follow-up question is, you know, because in these types of situations, my first thought is, well, did Mother Nature get it wrong, or did we? Like, are we inherently... Were we made to be dysfunctional or faulty? I just have a hard time believing that. And do babies even, I'm really interested in liver function. And my question is, do babies even possess the liver function needed to process 25D?
That's a great question.
Babies will actually, it's really interesting. They will turn the D3 into a different form of 25D called epi. And the normal pathway is it gets hydroxylated. So it's hydroxy vitamin D. So that's the pathway, hydroxylation. Well, there's another pathway in all kinds of molecules, not just vitamin D. There are epi forms of them. Epimerization, it's another form. Lactinization is another form. The body has lots of choices of what to turn vitamin D3 into. Remember, it's just like flour. And so the children that have been supplemented, not in general, they have up to 60% of their 25D is Epi 3 25D. It's a different form. And only the best tests will detect that. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, they're only going to be getting 40% of their vitamin D. They're going to stay labeled in spite of supplementation. They're going to stay labeled deficient. And that's just one molecule that somebody had some money to study and find. How do we know what other molecules? Here's the most interesting thing about the epimerization molecules. They're not at play in calcifying you. So their bodies are making a conscious decision to make a non-calcemic analog of vitamin D from D3 inputs. It's probably a protective mechanism.
Wow.
It's pretty cool.
Wow.
Yeah. There's a ton of molecules that the body can just decide. Yeah. It's the poor kids. They don't. And then if you were to go, and we use mice to check this stuff, the mice, none of that system's even online that we look at and credit with all the bone building. And they still have built a bone system without any of it being online. But that may just be because they're different, or we put the wrong emphasis. We wanted vitamin D to control calcium in every fashion in the body. And that's not its main role, because what we labeled a calcium sensing receptor, that's just, we called it that. It may not even be at play with calcium. And a lot of the receptors turned out to be that way, like in the brain. Of course, those are, they're not going to be bringing calcium to the brain, you know, God forbid, I hope not. Maybe they are, if at certain thresholds, maybe that's why people get plaques and whatnot. But the body has umpteen choices. We focused in through rickets and yeast. It was yeast. It was D2 that got us started, and it was Fleshman's and cod liver oil at the inception. And we've always been focused on the D3 molecule ever since. And then they've taken it to this new level where they got focused on a 2,5-D molecule, and they got to set the goal for it.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I just needed to digest that one.
I'm glad you liked it.
Oh, you all just blow my mind. So my final question for my community of listeners that are not, like, I'll be honest, some of the brainiacs, or as Morley calls them, the gearheads, have found this show. So I have some maybe more complex questions, but as far as my simple questions, this is the last one. And I really loved the way you both explained this in the last episode. And I think you even had some slides that really showed, brought clarity to this. But if you don't mind, just in simple terms, explaining the relationship between vitamin D and autoimmunity. I have a lot of listeners that suffer from autoimmune conditions who are constantly being told by their doctors to take 10,000 IUs of vitamin D a day or something ridiculous. And so there's something that's not clicking there that I would love to shed light on.
Wow, that's interesting. So the goal would be to just spike an immune response to deal with what we've labeled an autoimmune disease. Am I following you correctly?
Right.
Right. What's the phrase? Don't try to understand stupid. Like I can't justify that in my head.
Right. Well, part of the problem is that the autoimmune diseases, first of all, if you really look at most of them are actually collagen vascular diseases. So you might want to look at collagen, you know, at the root, and then all these other molecules and how they're at play with it. And did you maybe, some people through diet choices, it's hard to get your collagen depending upon what your diet is. And so that's part of it. But a true autoimmune disease would be one where, it's ironic that I was just reading this and I brought it up earlier, would be when the toll-like receptors, instead of seeing a TB molecule as an attack on the body, they start seeing natural molecules as an attack on the body, and they attack it. And there's only a few diseases that really, I think, fit that. I'm thinking maybe like sarcoidosis, certain skin lesion-based ones like eczema and psoriasis, maybe ones that have those kind of lesions inside, like celiacs, probably has those presentations in the gut, I would think. So it depends on what they're calling autoimmune diseases. But the reason they are able to get away with taking that much vitamin D is because their body doesn't want it, because it's already pulled back its expression of receptors. Mm-hmm. That's what's happening when the receptors are stolen. The vitamin D can't get to it, and the gene realizes it. And so it downregulates their receptors so they aren't stolen. And so there's not a bunch of vitamin D running unabated, stealing the other systems. So more vitamin D isn't going to fix that. The vast majority of it's going to be ignored. The number of receptors in your body sets your sensitivity. So if you're deluged with vitamin D, it pulls back expression. If you get very little of it through diet, let's say maybe it's that time of year that's the only source, your body may have more receptors, but your body is in control of how much vitamin D it takes in. And you notice when they haven't taken all that, if that same patient was suffering low protein, they would be doing a bunch of lab work to see if the protein's just going through them. They'd be doing some really no fun labs with these people, in fact, looking for malabsorption and stuff like that. Never with vitamin D, the mantra is always take more. Oh, it's plenty safe. Well, that's because everybody's body that's already in trouble is ignoring it. To do that to somebody whose body isn't ignoring it, those are the people we see getting harmed.
Yeah. That's right. Wow. So one point we haven't really raised so far is there's a difference in how vitamin A and vitamin D respond to the immune system or influence the immune system. And Jim just used the word downregulate. Well, vitamin A downregulates the immune system, calms it down, gets it to you know, ratchet back down to where it should be. Vitamin D suppresses the immune system, like putting a pillow over someone who's sleeping. That's suppression, but that doesn't mean that's the right thing to do. And I think the part that we need to really understand about autoimmune is it's a recent phenomenon. It's about 30 years old, and it involves over 100 different conditions now. I mean, it's a huge spectrum of conditions that people are dealing with. Well, I was doing some research earlier this week and came across references to what are called hemosiderin-laden macrophages. So let's back up. Mm-hmm. Jim has referred to macrophages a couple times. Those are the Pac-Men that gobble up all the debris, but especially the dying red blood cells. They play a very critical role in helping to maintain the freshness, if you will, of our blood supply. Mm. People have heard of ferritin. Ferritin is an iron storage. We're talking about vitamin D storage, but this is an iron storage protein. And it's kind of like an ATM machine. You can put iron in, you can take iron out, put it in, put it out, in, out. But if there is metabolic dysfunction, as there often is, in a body that starts to accumulate iron. And I know this program's not about iron, but I just want to make sure people understand what autoimmune is. But when the iron starts to build, it starts to affect how that iron gets stored. And it no longer is stored in ferritin. It's stored in something called hemosiderin. And hemosiderin is like a bank vault that requires a key and a combination. And it's really complicated to get it out. And so we've got this ATM machine, we've got this big bank vault. And I the reason why I was intrigued by this article was it was talking about how hemosiderin macrophages end up in the brain and show up as calcium in CAT scans and MRIs. We could talk for 2 hours about that alone, but we're not going to. But the significance is that iron accumulation is a very bad thing. And I sent this article out to a group of people, and one of my radiology friends wrote back and he said, "Oh my gosh, this explains an article that I read several years ago that every autoimmune condition involves hemosiderin-laden macrophages." The bottom line is, folks, every autoimmune condition has iron accumulation coming out the yin-yang, and no one's talking about that. And I don't know what role vitamin D plays in that process, again, other than suppressing symptoms. And that seems to be the strategy du jour, is always to kind of put black tape over the dashboard or suppress the problem. Mm-hmm. But autoimmune means that the tissue has lost its true north and it's attacking itself. It's not thinking clearly. And when you lose a lot of energy, you do start to think differently, right? I mean, we've all been there. And so when you have too much iron in the tissue, energy production plummets, and then the tissue begins to behave very differently. So I don't have a good explanation for why vitamin D would be involved in that or why you would use it other than suppression. But I think people need to know that autoimmune hemosiderin-laden macrophages and, drumroll, parasites. Every one of them involves a pathogen, but especially parasites, to cause the dysfunction, the metabolic dysfunction that might be, whether it's for a nose or lupus or diabetes, you name it. All of these different conditions have excess iron and a pathogen. So just wanted to share that.
Right. And I agree, energy is at the heart of all of it, energy production. Right. And there are pathogens that have a mycoplasma, have a sterile cholesterol metabolism, and they will eat their way into a cell and steal the ATP right there as it's made, because right. they don't have enough of to be self-sufficient. They're just complete parasites. They have such a small genome. But it's possible that the tie there, Morley, is the VDR gene and brown and white fat.
Yep. Yep.
I think that might be because it flips the switch of which fat's made. And so okay. that might be at play in what you're talking about.
Fascinating.
I'm so grateful for you. I love our conversations. You really get me to think differently and ask. I love the types of questions that, you know, because I'm going to leave this conversation and go digest it and have like all of these. I tell Morley anytime I have a phone call with you, it's like 4 hours later that I'm going, you know, having an aha right. moment, because this just sticks with me. So anyways, I'm super grateful for you. And thanks for this conversation.
Whew, that was a lot of information. If you liked this episode, again, please consider sharing with a friend or family member. Subscribe to the podcast, give us a rating and review, talk about us on social media. Again, we don't monetize this program. I want you to know that you're getting information that is not bought. My opinion cannot and will not ever be bought. So anyways, thank you all, and I'll see you next time. Be well and be kind.